You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Dan Futterman and Adam Reff, writers and executive producers of Amazon Prime's American Rust. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
We ended on such a cliffhanger, you know, with Isaac presenting the wrench at the police station to Jeff Daniels' character. It allowed us to sort of start from a place of what's going to happen next. And I think because what is drawn in the novel and because of what Danny brought into the original script of the first season and all the ideas he brought in, we started talking about the relationship between Del Harris and Grace Poe and what is the ambiguity there? Who's essentially, I say this a lot, who's zooming who, you know, and to not ever land on one side of it because we're all culpable in some way of being both good and bad, being virtuous and also questionable at times in our own lives. And I think when you start answering questions on either side of that too firmly, it allows the audience to disconnect from it. And then they go, oh, he's a monster or she's a monster. And then you just have this sort of a good and bad guy, good and bad woman narrative that is oversimplified all too often in our culture. So I think with the way season one was built, when we thought about season two, we were trying to run with a lot of the same ideas, even when you go from Isaac's sexuality discovery and the way he's living his life and who he's trusting and who he's giving blind faith to, down to Billy, and who is he becoming? Is he going to become, you know, someone who shoots people, or is he going to become someone who chooses love and romance? And I think we kept our North Star about where that gray area is for all our characters. And Rob Yang's character comes to mind too, Steve Park, who is driven by the truth and driven by finding justice at all costs to the point where he becomes so self-obsessed, he becomes toxic in his own way and hellbent to find the solution to that mystery in West Virginia.
I was thinking about this and knowing we were going to have this conversation, and it felt to me like a lot of the drive of season two is about payback. There are people who feel they're owed things. They want payback. There are people who feel like they have to get back at people because they've been wronged in some way. And for Steve Park, that Adam just spoke with, there's a feeling of the justice of payback. Something was done that was terribly, terribly wrong, and he's going to right it. And in a way, every character has something, some way that they're trying to right the wrong that was done to them or that they did in the first season. I mean, Jeff is really driven, Jeff's character, Del Harris, really driven by trying to right what he sees as wrongs that he did in the first season. And he's staying a little bit away from Grace because he doesn't know how much to blame her for it, how much were his own decisions or how much she kind of drove him to do things, like Adam is saying. So that was fun to explore. There's a lot of intertwined stories because of this. So that was a big driver, at least in my mind, and I think in all of our minds.
I think the whole fracking story, which was really fascinating to get into, I think Grace is getting into it to better her life, to give herself more solvency, to make herself feel good for the first time in, you know, 45, 50 years. And yet, even when she starts to field complaints from people who are getting their land poisoned and their animals are getting sick, she continues to press on. And we see her as being a good mother. We see her as being like a mama bear in some ways, you know, in a very moral way. And then we see her kind of acquiescing to the system of fracking and allowing some of these things to slide by. So just that storyline alone, I think there's a lot of interesting turning away from the truth in order to kind of justify or rationalize one's behavior.
We did a lot of reading about fracking. There are a lot of books and articles, and we did make a determination to not take a side on this. Anything that we read seemed to really have two sides to this. I mean, it can bring an enormous amount of economic opportunity. It can also, if you are unlucky enough to be living downstream of someone's fracking site, bring a lot of ecological problems. And yet, there's no collective decision on it. And we want to show that there is good in this and there is danger in it, and just let the different characters experience that and make their own decisions based on who we felt like we'd established they were through the first season. It was a really different experience doing this second season, having felt like we really got to know these characters by the end of the first season.
Looking at both of your bodies of work, I was struck by how much your writing beyond American Rust involved adaptations. What is it like when you're working with authors who are still alive, or the challenges of telling historical events or the stories of people who are no longer with us?
With The Outsiders in particular, S.C. Hinton, Susie Hinton wrote that when she was 15 and 16. It was published when she was 17. She was told by her editors, or one editor in particular, that she couldn't have any swear words. So she was sort of forced to write about these very big, intense love and death operatic themes where, you know, there's a boy who dies by suicide by cop. There's a boy who dies from a fire. So it's about grief. His parents die in a car crash. Prior to all that, and there's this hugely stacked deck of grief that exists in the novel. But when you read the novel, there's a very sweet and loving tone to it. So when I started working on it, I recalled my childhood in Joliet, Illinois. My mom was a single parent. She raised three kids on her own on a nurse's salary. We grew up in a kind of rough apartment complex in Joliet, Illinois. And I remember swearing my head off. You know, I remember having a different kind of relationship to language, to the boys around me, the girls around me, to what sexuality was, what it meant to be a virgin, what it meant to be skipping school. And so when I entered, I wanted to make sure that in adapting it, because adults were going to be coming, they were going to be paying for this, you know, whether it's $100 or $200 a ticket, whatever it is, I wanted it to feel like an adult experience. So I had to give myself permission to take her great dark themes and actions that are in her novel and give language to it that was also from an adult world. I'm shocked that I'm seeing like 7 and 8 year olds and 9 year olds in the audience with their parents. The parents who grew up reading the book are now bringing their kids to the theater. And I'm really moved by that. I think kids are a lot smarter. I don't have kids, so I'm speaking from ignorance here, but my experience being a kid and my experience being around kids, I think they're more sophisticated in terms of narrative and digesting narrative than maybe some of us give them credit for. There's a lot of really amazing librarians who all believe that. There are also a lot of very conservative librarians who want to protect kids from tougher materials. I'm really moved to see younger kids coming to the theater and seeing this very, very difficult show.
I write with my wife sometimes, Anya Epstein, who's a terrific writer. We did In Treatment together the third season. That's actually where we met Adam. That was a kind of in-between thing in terms of adaptation. There had been two seasons, but the Israeli version, Betipul, was only two seasons. So we were sort of left to make it what we wanted and make up characters. And that was pretty thrilling. Adam wrote a great series of sessions for the wonderful actor, Irfan Khan, who unfortunately died not that long ago. And we're writing something now that's not an adaptation. It's been really freeing and wonderful to do. Each project brings with it different challenges. We had a very, very good experience on Looming Tower. Adam and I both worked on that. Lawrence Wright was kind of in and out of the writer's room. And he is just an incredible font of information. Even though the book is quite long and packed with information, he just had more to give and contacts with all of these people, CIA, FBI, State Department. That was incredible to be able to tap into. And then there are ones that can be a little more difficult sometimes if people have very strong ideas of where they want something to go. And you just have to work as a writer within those constraints and try to find your own creativity within it. It can be challenging, but that's the job, you know, that's what you're given. And particularly in film, it's often driven by the director and you're serving that master and trying to get your voice and your creativity into that box that you've been given. And I don't mean that necessarily pejoratively. It can be possible that the director is totally right about these things. It's just that you would have done it differently. And so trying to absorb that and then run it through your process and your creativity and put something out that feels true can be challenging.
As you think about the future and the importance of the arts, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I believe that we've kind of become more and more desensitized through video games, through the violent images. Our capacity to ingest violent content, our permission to ingest it has to be doing something to our brains. And I don't know what the solution is, but I think theater is really powerful because you're going to watch something, you're witnessing it, you're participating, you're collaborating. In that way, it's a political act. You're watching something that's going down right in front of you, and it can change your life. Right now, live theater is much different than looking at a screen. It's much different than looking at your computer or your Game Boy or whatever. I see grown men on the subway playing video games on their phones, and we're not even looking at each other in the subways anymore. We're like deep in a screen. And I wonder what that's done. So I think theater actually has a powerful ability to rewire us to the human experience. And maybe because of it, maybe we can find more empathy or more the capacity toward kindness.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.